and it went like.
Welcome. This is Elsbeth Magilton, one of your hosts for the Girls Code Lincoln podcast.
And I'm Akriti Agarwal. In March 2020, our clubs, like organizations around the world, had to shut down. During that time, we still wanted to be there to support and inspire our students. Focusing on confidence and life skills, we started the Empower presentation series. Our speakers met directly with our clubs online, and the talks are available on the Girls Code Lincoln YouTube channel. The speakers in the series have a variety of careers and backgrounds. We know that confidence and leadership skills matter in every industry. Even as our club started back up, we recognized the need for kids to continue hearing from confident, underrepresented voices in our community, perhaps now more than ever.
This spring, in conjunction with the Women Lead Conference sponsored by the University of Nebraska Colleges of Business and Law, we're reviving the Empower Her series on the podcast. We've invited speakers at this one-day conference to join Akriti and I for interviews that will come out as standalone episodes in the Empower series. We are so pleased to welcome Connie Collingsworth, the Chief Operating Officer for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, to the show today. Welcome, Connie.
Welcome. Connie, would you start us off by introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about what you do?
My name is Connie Collingsworth, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I also hold the title Chief Legal Officer.
Very cool. So what does that mean? What kind of tasks would you end up doing?
So that means that I'm the leader of a number of divisions within the foundation. That includes information technology, the legal team, the human resources team, the global security team, the business design team, the grants and contracts management team, all of the business operation functions that support the foundation's programmatic work. In addition, we have 9 regional offices around the world, and so I'm responsible for the operational support of those offices. And we also have entities that we've formed that are separate businesses, the Gates Medical Research Institute in Boston, the Gates Ag One in St. Louis, and providing operational support for those entities is also part of my job.
That's a lot of hats.
Yes, it is.
So let's start at the, we'll get close more into all of that later, which I'm really excited to learn more about, but let's start at the beginning. Where are you from? And tell us a little bit about your childhood.
So I was born and raised in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I went away to college in Michigan and then came back to Nebraska to go to law school. Then I left to go practice law in Oklahoma and met my husband there. We worked in Oklahoma for about 18 months, and then we went and got an advanced law degree in international business law in England. Then we came back and went to Houston, which is where he wanted us to live. Worked there for about 3 years, and then in 1987, we moved to Seattle, which is where we've lived since then.
Very cool. And what led you as a child to this career? Did you know that this is what you wanted to do when you were growing up?
I don't know when I actually made the decision, but I have a very distinct memory of standing in the line at my high school graduation, and one of the fathers of my girlfriend asking me what I planned to do after graduation and announcing very boldly that I was going to be a lawyer. So I knew at least from that day and had no doubt. I didn't know what kind of lawyer I was going to be, but it was a dream of mine to go to law school.
So one of my favorite questions is always, what is the major that you declared on the day you started college, and what was it when you graduated? It sounds like maybe you knew early in high school, or in high school at least, that you wanted to be a lawyer, but tell us a little bit more about your undergraduate experience.
So I did hedge my bets. I was an English major. I like to write. I like to argue. I like to debate. And I thought if I didn't end up wanting to go to law school, I might have another alternative to be a journalist or even a teacher. So I really enjoyed writing and reading and had an English major. I went through school and college in 3 years and kept that major throughout those 3 years.
Did you have any internships or externships while you were in college? Can you tell us about those?
So during college, I did not. It was part of the fact that I went through in 3 years. I did go to school in France for one summer, and that later became interesting in my life. I started the French-American School of Puget Sound, which now has 450 students in it. But I was pretty much full-time in school as part of going through in 3 years.
All right, so let's turn to law school then. What was your law school experience like? What brought you back to Nebraska for law school?
Well, my family is still in Lincoln. I have three brothers and both parents, and I wanted to come back home, and that was one of the reasons I went to the University of Nebraska. I don't think I realized that I was interested in business law until I started taking some classes on corporate law and business law. I remember distinctly even exploring the idea of doing public defender work or other things. And I signed up for a program that the law school had created with the U.S. with the Nebraska Penitentiary. And I remember being assigned someone who was a prisoner there to help them with their appeal. And he never, ever showed up for any of the meetings. And so when I drive by the penitentiary, it brings back that memory and how different my course career has gone from that, and just fell in love with the business courses, which is similar to the family I grew up in. My father and my brothers are all business people. They're all entrepreneurs. They own their own businesses. My father had his own business, and so do all three of my brothers. So I think the entrepreneurial side of my DNA took over, and I discovered business law, where you could sit at a table and negotiate. And I really like the fact that both sides want to do a deal versus in litigation, there's a winner and a loser. And sometimes I'm not always sure that the right person wins.
Yeah.
Or the tactics that come up in law that are all about asking for documents and depositions are all always efficient way to get to the answers. I like getting things done and things that both people want to do. And that's what business law has allowed me to help with.
Yeah, that's really cool. You talked a little bit about the differences in your career, and it seems like you've moved around quite a bit. Would you talk us through your first job to where you are now and what that journey was like?
My first job as a lawyer, I got as an intern for the summer at the largest firm in Oklahoma. And I went to that firm because they did international law, which I was interested in. And they represented large oil and gas companies around the world. Plus, I had family that I could live with there. So I went and did a summer internship after my second year of law school. And the way it typically works is that you often get your permanent job offer as a result of those internships, which is what happened. But I met my husband as an intern during that same summer, and that dictated part of those other moves that happened after that.
So talk about a little bit maybe about the transition from practicing law, and I assume that maybe you're a little bit less in the actual practice now and a little bit more in the leadership strategy and that piece of it, and that transition from that law practice life to what you do now.
So I still hold the title Chief Legal Officer, which means that I'm the advisor to the co-chairs of the foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates, Bill Gates and Melinda French Gates. And they asked me to provide them advice. For example, in conjunction with their recent divorce, we've recreated a new governance structure for the foundation, which was one of my responsibilities over the last 9 months. So that was still practicing law. But the legal team now has 45 people on it, and it was too much to manage the day-to-day issues and all the other things I described. And so for the most part, I don't practice law. But I had expanded my role over the last 6 or 7 years by taking on each of these additional areas of responsibility. That happened typically because I would say something is broken and I would suggest there would be a solution. And they'd say, okay, then do it. And so each area got added sequentially. So for a while, my title was Chief Business Officer. And then they had a departure in the human resources, and they asked me to also wear the hat of the interim chief human resources officer, which I did for 10 months. And then they said, well, now why don't we have that division report to you? So my portfolio has just continued to expand to the point where, as you say, I don't really practice law, but I provide strategic and operational support for the foundation generally. And so it's happened gradually over time. And then I still have to make a lot of the hardest calls. If they really are at the highest level legally, I end up having to be either consulted or make the final decision or recommendation.
How do you handle all of these different hats that you're wearing? What kind of balancing do you do, and how do you prioritize your time?
Personally,
I'm very, very intentional about how I work and how I spend my time. So the way I can effectively do that is by hiring great teams with great leaders who do most of the work, frankly. I meet with those team leaders to give them direction and guidance and support, make sure they've got the right resources, make sure that I listen to what the issues are. But most of the work is not done by me. It's done by them. And so a lot of it has to do with hiring great talent and delegating responsibility. And then personally, I'm very, very strict about how many hours I work. I don't send emails after 5:30. I don't send emails before 8 in the morning. I don't send emails on the weekend. And in turn, I don't read them unless it's an urgent situation. And so I make sure that I sleep 8 hours a day and I walk 5 miles a day and I read a book every month. And I have all kinds of things outside of work that give me broader perspective. And so I don't let work consume my life.
That's so hard to do. That's amazing that you've been able to keep that.
I think it's easier now that my daughters are grown. It was a harder struggle when I was also a full-time mother. And it's gotten a lot easier, frankly.
I think that I struggle with that big time. So it's always sure. Nice to hear people who have those boundaries enforce those boundaries and that those are working. And it's aspirational to get there.
Yeah, you have to control your life. If you let others control it for you, then I think that's when you can get into those bad habits. And obviously, I have more control now, given the position I hold. But I think it's important as a leader to set that standard for everyone on your team.
Absolutely. So we call this part of the show the fill in the blank section. So it's what is the blank part of your career? And the first fill in the blank is the best. What is the best part of your career?
Working with great other really smart people.
What is the hardest part?
I think it's making hard decisions when people don't work out.
Yeah, that's. I agree with that. That is a really hard part of anyone's career is figuring out how to counsel people when things are bad. Easy when things are going well. Do you think your legal background is probably a huge bonus? I always find it useful. I don't really practice law now, but have a legal training, and we're problem solvers, right? Like that's what we're trained to do is work in conflict. And be comfortable in conflict and be able to find a solution when there's conflict. Do you find that is an asset to you when you're dealing with something that's maybe not even a legal question, but is still sort of a conflict you need to solve?
I'm sure. I'm not intimidated at all by it because I think we're trained to go into those scenarios and look for the solution. I think you have to balance that sometimes with learning to listen and not jump to the solution too quickly. But I have no problem making decisions, and I credit my legal training and background both with the comfort but also the process that you think through, understanding the pros and cons and the risks. So lawyers are often really good at risk analysis, and I think that helps you make really well-informed decisions is to think through unintended consequences and think through both sides. Some people jump to their answer and they want to get to yes, and then aren't thorough in thinking through all of the various alternatives and repercussions. So I think my legal training has helped me do what lawyers do, which is often called due diligence, and understanding the risks that I think make me a stronger leader because I've had that training.
What is the scariest part of your career or your job?
I don't find it scary. I don't know if that's an acceptable answer, but I just embrace, I like the challenge. And I feel like any challenge can be met head on. And so I don't find it to be scary.
Yeah, one of the things that we talk about a lot with STEM careers and women in a lot of areas of leadership is imposter syndrome. And you've talked about not feeling like you face imposter syndrome. Can you talk to us about how you got there? As somebody who struggles with it myself a lot.
Well, that's hard to say. I just don't know if it's DNA or I don't think my parents never pushed me. And they just always told me I could do whatever I wanted. And I have three brothers and I've always just, I've had an innate sense of confidence, not because I was brighter or smarter or anything, but I just figured hard work would get you what you needed to go and have found that a lot of people hold themselves back. And I don't like to listen to those voices in your head. I think that you should define yourself and not let others define you. And I think that's when you start to have doubts. Is someone says, well, why do you think you're qualified? And it's like, who are you to tell me whether I am or not? And so I block those kind of conversations either from my own head or from others away. So I just don't entertain them.
Yeah, that's awesome.
What is the most rewarding part of your career?
Being able to work today at an organization that is helping hundreds of millions of lives be better, not just working for profit or working for pay or making earnings that a lot of companies are doing, but being in a nonprofit that has an amazing mission that is really making an impact on people's lives around the whole world. It was the reason I switched from practicing law in a large law firm, because I was doing a lot of mergers and acquisition work, making a lot of rich people richer, but felt like if I looked back in my career and that's all I said I'd done, that I would have left something short. And now the last 20 years, I can say I've contributed to saving a lot of lives through babies that have been vaccinated, mothers who've gotten care. There's, you know, I could go on and on about the foundation's mission, but contributing to those goals is really a rewarding thing to get to be part of.
Could you tell us a little bit more? There might be listeners out there who maybe have heard of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, but aren't that familiar with the mission and some of the amazing work that you all do.
So the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation was formed about 20 years ago with the money primarily coming from Bill Gates and his wealth created through Microsoft. And then in 2006, Warren Buffett made a commitment to give away a significant amount of his wealth. And part of that has come to the foundation. And at this stage, we give away over $7.5 billion every year. So it's a lot of money to give away responsibly. We have 41 different strategies in a number of areas. One is global health, which is a lot of working on vaccine. So if you got the vaccine for COVID and it was either Pfizer or Moderna, that technology, which was developed so quickly, called the RNA technology, was something we funded years ago as part of our work on creating better vaccines. So that's one of the things we're most well known for, because there's a lot of disparity in the world where if you're a child in the U.S., you routinely get your childhood vaccinations of mumps and measles. Polio, for example, hasn't existed in the rich countries for a long time. But there's now only two countries left in the world who still have polio, Pakistan and Afghanistan. And the foundation's number one highest priority is getting those last children vaccinated. And so it's really getting to the children of the world, those same things we take for granted that should be readily available, because most vaccines cost cents on a dollar. And another great example is there's a large part of the population in the developing and low and middle income countries where the women don't have access to contraceptives because the big pharmaceutical companies didn't think they could make enough money in those markets. So they just didn't pay attention to them. And we went to them and said, we will guarantee in bulk that if you sell X amount of these contraceptives in a market you hadn't thought about before, we will guarantee if you sell them at this low enough price that they will all be bought. And we will be the backup financial guarantee to incentivize you to go into those new markets. And as a result, we have gotten hundreds of millions of doses of contraceptives to those women so they can control the spacing of their birth and have the number of children they want. But our guarantee has never, ever been called. We've never had to pay a penny because they just didn't think of those areas as places to go. And as a result of using our voice and our leverage of our balance sheet, they knew we were good for the money if we had to pay it, but we just needed to bring attention and focus to that issue that other markets in the world needed some of these developments that we take for granted. So those are just a few examples of a number of the things that we do. We also work on education in the U.S. We work on agriculture, water, and sanitation. We work on financial services for the poor, particularly women, getting access to bank accounts. So as I said, we have 41 strategies and you don't have enough time, but it is really exciting to be able to learn in all those areas, ways we can help.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing to see all of the work that you do around the world. Can you talk a little bit about, well, the world is very big and I'm sure all of these issues are handled differently in different cultures. Can you talk a little bit about how you kind of tackle that?
It's important to work with our partners. We don't actually do the work. We give money to fund the work. And so it's finding people on the ground who understand the root cause of the problem, who understand how to implement it in their environment, and then to give them the resources and support that can make the change happen.
So as we start to wind up our time together, we always like to end on inspiration. But one of the things I like to talk about when I think about things that inspire me are big failures, moments of growth and change and transition in our lives. And I know you keynoted earlier today, and I think you got this question in the audience. You can answer differently today, too, if you'd like to. But could you tell us about a big failure in your life?
Well, in my life.
Or in your career.
In my career, it's, I think, important to always learn from your mistakes. And if you don't have mistakes, that means you're not stretching yourself. So I think the example I gave is just stepping back at one point to question whether or not I wanted to continue practicing full time or whether I wanted to step aside and stay at home with the children. And so at one point in my career, I did step aside for 2 years. And I wouldn't call that a mistake or a failure, but I would call it a lesson that reconfirmed for me that I found that I personally was happier as a working mother and that I would be better as a role model for my 2 daughters by continuing to work than if I stayed home full time and devoted all of my attention to them. And so to me, that was a really amazing opportunity that I took the time away to reaffirm for myself that that was the best thing I needed for myself and my family.
We also like to talk about our big successes. So can you share with us a success in your life or your work that you're very proud of?
So one of the things the foundation does is, as I was describing in its work with big companies on technology development. Bill Gates, our founder, obviously believes that technology is a solution for a lot of problems. So when I joined the foundation in the first place, I said, you're not getting the kind of commitments from people that you're giving money to ensure that we will actually get the benefits of those technologies if they're successful. And so I saw that we were giving the money, but that we didn't really have the right commitments coming back. And so in partnership with others in the foundation, I developed and created a concept called global access. And so what we say is in exchange for this money, if the technology works, you commit to us that you will have a global access strategy that will make that technology available in the low and middle income countries at an affordable price. And we now work with companies, the largest companies all over the world. And it's really interesting you walk in today because I started this almost 20 years ago and say there's no reason to partner with you if you won't make a commitment for global access. And before you'd have to say, this is what that means, or they think you were venture capital money or that you would just give them money because you're a charity. And now they say, oh yes, I know what global access is. I understand that and we'll partner with you. And it went from an idea of we need this to actually do more than just create science for the sake of science, but actually get the technology into the beneficiaries that we're trying to help. And so I'm proud of having really raised the idea that we need that as part of being a lawyer in our agreements, and having that phrase now become pretty well known. In fact, all of our grantees have to commit to that, and we make about 3,500 grants a year, and every grant agreement has a global access commitment that they have to make to us in exchange for getting money.
The articulation of accountability there. That's fantastic. So what for our last question as we wind up, what is the biggest piece of advice you would have to a young woman finding their way?
Just have confidence in yourself. You can do it, and don't let those voices get into your head. Just turn them off and go for your dream, whatever it is. You can always change your mind. And I expect, as you would say from many of your interviews, people do. Nobody's career usually goes from one end to the other straight line. But just don't be the one to hold yourself back. There's plenty of other people who will try to hold you back. Don't hold yourself.
I love that. That's such important advice. And thank you so much for your time today, Connie.
Thank you.
And for all the amazing work you do.
Well, thank you for all your work on these stories and reaching out to young girls, because that's the time you have to be more confident than ever, is when you're in the middle school and high school years. I think that's when the doubts start. Just don't let those thoughts go in your head and let them grow. Stop them early.
I hope you all heard that, listeners, and thank you so much for being with us today. Thank you to Lysandra Marquez, a Girls Code Lincoln volunteer and the technical producer of this podcast. Our theme music is Then It Went Like by Grace Mesa.
Girls Code Lincoln is a 501c3 nonprofit organization in Lincoln, Nebraska, where we strive to ignite a passion for technology and leadership in young girls with the long-term goal of closing the gender gap in STEM. Learn more at girlscodelincoln.org.
Thanks to our Girls Code Lincoln sponsors, including Fuse Co-working for our beautiful space, the Nebraska Governance and Technology Center at the University of Nebraska for technical services,
and the Mentors Foundation, Huddle, Assurity, Emeritus, and Don't Panic Labs for their organizational support. Want to hear from more women in coding and business? Tell your friends about this podcast and share it on social media. Word of mouth is our best advertising. Good night.